And welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, April 12th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. President Joe Biden calling for calm after sometimes violent protests broke out Sunday following a deadly police shooting of a black man in a Minneapolis suburb, a shooting that the police chief now says was an accident, that the officer mistakenly used a gun instead of a taser. This comes as the judge in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of another black man, George Floyd, says no to a defense request to sequester the jury or question the jurors about what they know of Sunday's protests. President Joe Biden meets with a bipartisan group of lawmakers on infrastructure spending. He's proposed over $2 trillion, paid for with a corporate tax rate increase, but says he's willing to negotiate and insists the meeting with Republicans is not window dressing. And today is the 40th anniversary of the first launch of the space shuttle, the world's first reusable spacecraft. Hundreds of protesters Sunday night in the streets of Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, a suburb of Minneapolis, after a 20-year-old black man, Dante Wright, was shot and killed by a police officer. Some businesses were broken into. Protesters jumped on a police car, rocks and other objects thrown at police. They fired tear gas and flashbang grenades to disperse the crowd. Wright's car had been pulled over for having expired tags. Police found he had an outstanding warrant and attempted an arrest. Today, the police chief of Brooklyn Center, Tim Gannon, says the officer in Sunday's shooting mistook her handgun for a taser gun. He released body camera video that showed Dante Wright pulling away from another police officer trying to handcuff him, getting back into his car. Then the first officer shouts, "Taser," before firing her gun. President Joe Biden spoke about this at the White House.
We've spoken to the governor, the mayor, spoken to the authorities there, and I haven't called Dante Wright's family, but our prayers with their family. It's really a tragic thing that happened. But I think we got to wait and see what the investigation shows, and the entire investigation. You all watched, I assume as I did, the film, which is fairly the body cam, which is fairly graphic. Question is, was it an accident? Was it intentional? That remains to be determined by a full-blown investigation. But in the meantime, I want to make it clear again, there is absolutely no justification, none, for looting, no justification for violence. Peaceful protest, understandable. And the fact is that, you know, we do know that the anger, pain, and trauma that exists in the black community in that environment is real. It's serious and it's consequential. But it will not justify violence and or looting. And so the question is how we, in an orderly way, make clear that they get down to a full-blown investigation to determine what the facts are and what is likely to happen. In the meantime, we're calling for peace and calm. And we should listen to Dante's mom, who is calling for peace and calm. And that's all I have to say at this moment on that issue. So,
Mr. President, do you think there should be federal resources to help keep peace? Do you think we need to take any additional?
There are already federal resources, and we have a significant, we spent a significant amount of time unrelating to this particular case and dealing with what may be the aftermath of anything that happens with the trial that's underway. But there will not be lack of help support from the federal government if the local authorities believe it's needed.
Are you concerned this could be on a razor's edge, sir?
I'm not going to speculate now. I'm hopeful that there will be a verdict and an outcome that will be supported by the vast majority of the people in the region, and that's my expectation and hope. Thank you.
President Joe Biden at the White House. Minnesota's professional baseball, basketball, and hockey teams announced they've postponed their Monday games out of respect after that Sunday shooting. And as you heard referenced, Sunday's shooting took place only about 10 miles from where another black man, George Floyd, died almost a year ago while in police custody. And the trial of one of the officers in that case, Derek Chauvin, now entering its third week of testimony. Today, Judge Peter Cahill declined a defense request to immediately sequester the jury and question the jurors about what, if anything, they have seen or heard about Sunday night's protests.
I'm going to deny the motion to sequester the jury and for additional voir dire. This is a totally different case. I realize there's civil unrest, and maybe some of the jurors did hear about that. The reason why, in my initial order, I said we're not going to sequester, but we might go to it in the middle of trial if, and the concern there was that despite keeping jurors anonymous, that somebody may find out who one of the jurors is and reach out and have an inappropriate attempt to tamper with the jury. We have no indication that that's happened in this case, and that was the concern about going to sequestration. I understand the argument from the defense that this now puts them even more ill at ease, but I think sequestering them would only aggravate that. Oh, I heard about the civil unrest, and now the judge is putting us into sequestration. There must be a greater threat to our security. I think the better way is to just continue with the trial as we've been going, that's a separate issue. They should treat it as such. It'd be a different story if it was civil unrest following another verdict, where the jury can see what the consequence of a certain verdict might be in a similar case, but that's not this case. The jurors all are aware and were concerned about their safety because of what happened in May of 2020, the civil unrest that followed there. Not a big surprise that there's now civil unrest in response to this case, but I don't think that should heighten the jurors' concern. I think it's probably the same as it was before. They all have a concern that they expressed and were very honest about, and so I'm not going to sequester them. We'll sequester them on Monday when we anticipate doing closings.
Federal District Court Judge Peter Cahill presiding in the Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis. So the prosecution's case continued today. First witness was Dr. Jonathan Rich. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reports that he is a medical expert in cardiology from Northwestern Memorial Hospital in the Chicago area, who the prosecution hopes to counter defense contentions that George Floyd died from health problems and illicit drug use. He was questioned by Minnesota Special Assistant Attorney General Jerry Blackwell.
Have you formed any opinions in this case to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to the cause of Mr. Floyd's death?
Yes, I have.
Would you tell us your opinion or opinions?
Sure. In this case, Mr. George Floyd died from a cardiopulmonary arrest. It was caused by low oxygen levels. And those low oxygen levels were induced by the prone restraint and positional asphyxiation that he was subjected to.
Well, let's discuss your opinion, Dr. Rich, and let's start it with just a general discussion of the circulatory system in the heart. So I'd like to talk about the right side of the heart, left side of the heart, and also the alveoli. Would you start off and just tell the jury, just remind them, what are the alveoli?
Sure. So you might remember hearing about this, but the alveoli are those grape-like structures that are at the very bottoms of the lungs. The alveoli is where the actual gas exchange occurs, meaning that is where, when we take a breath in, oxygen gets across the lungs and into the bloodstream, and then the carbon dioxide that needs to leave the body crosses that same barrier into those alveoli. So when we take our deep breath out, that's how the carbon dioxide is removed. So it's the alveoli of the lungs that serve that purpose.
Dr. Jonathan Rich testifying in the Derek Chauvin trial in the death of George Floyd. Another witness for the prosecution today was the younger brother of George Floyd, Felonious Floyd, who described George's close relationship with his mother and love for sports. You can watch the replay of each trial day's proceedings the same night at 8 p.m. Eastern on C-SPAN 2 television. The White House issuing infrastructure report cards today for all 50 states, rating the states on roads and bridges, public transportation, resilient infrastructure, drinking water, housing, broadband, and also some of the president's priorities that he's been calling infrastructure. Republicans have disagreed on some of this: caregiving, child care, manufacturing, and veterans' health, all to highlight the need, he says, for his proposed infrastructure spending bill, over $2 trillion. Most of the states getting a grade of a C or C-, only Georgia and Utah getting C-pluses. The president sat down today at the White House with eight lawmakers, representatives and senators, Republicans and Democrats.
I think that's where we're here. It's a bipartisan meeting here. We got the dean here. Don Young is here. We got the dean. So everything's going to be all right. But all kidding aside, I'm prepared to negotiate as to how the extent of my infrastructure project, as well as how we pay for it. But if we get in a serious conversation about how to do that, I think everyone acknowledges we need significant increase in infrastructure. It's going to get down to what we call infrastructure. Some people don't think that, I'm not suggesting anybody here has that view, but there's a lot of folks saying that the fact that we have millions of people not able to drink water because there's lead and it's coming through lead pipes, I think that's infrastructure. I think broadband is infrastructure. It's not just roads, bridges, highways, et cetera. So that's what we're going to talk about, and I'm confident everything's going to work out perfectly. I'm not big on window dressing, if you've observed. Thank you very much.
President Biden sitting down with Democrats and Republicans from the House and Senate to discuss his more than $2 trillion infrastructure spending proposal. Joining us now with more is Jeff Stein, Washington Post economics reporter. Who did the president invite to the White House, and why these lawmakers?
It's a very good question, because it's a very interesting list and kind of not who you would expect. It was a range of lawmakers from the House and Senate, Maria Cantwell of Washington State, David Price of North Carolina, Roger Wicker of Mississippi, Republicans, Democrats. It's a bipartisan group. Some of the members are on the Transportation Committee. It's a diverse group, but beyond that, we haven't really been able to figure out exactly why this group. It's a good question.
President said he's willing to negotiate with Republicans on this bill. Have we had any indication from both sides where the middle ground may be, if it exists?
The White House has been very adamant that they're interested in seeking middle ground and getting Republican votes, but when you look at their proposal, and particularly the tax provisions that they included, it's really hard to see how they envision anything close to what they've actually outlined being passed in a bipartisan way. Maybe they could dramatically change and, almost to the point of not even being recognizable anymore, the key elements of the plan here. There's maybe, this is off the top of my head, but maybe a sixth or a seventh the Biden plan overall that I could see Republicans going along with if, the other five, six were cut out. Whether the White House is really willing to sacrifice so much stuff that they have said is so vital for the country in order to get bipartisan support, I think is really hard to imagine, but certainly not impossible.
There were some initial concerns from Democratic progressives that $2.3 trillion is not large enough. Any potential problems on that side for the administration?
I think it's possible that not just on the progressive side, but that there were a lot of lawmakers in the House and Senate who really wanted to pass the American Rescue Plan, Biden's first effort, in part because they thought it was good legislation, but also because some of them really felt like it was, the president's first major effort and incumbent on them to give him a big win. And the goodwill will invariably start to fray the longer the administration goes on and the harder the choices it has to make. And you're already seeing, I spoke to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and she was saying that, if this is really the best chance we have to do something about climate change, in a potentially a very long time, that she's going to fight very hard to make sure it's a lot bigger. And whether that translates into actual threats to withhold votes to secure some form of leverage, I think, I don't want to get ahead of anyone's statement because nobody is saying that explicitly yet. But the idea is certainly there, and it would not shock me given how important making sure we do enough to deal with climate change is to so many of these lawmakers.
On that same token, if the Democrats do move ahead or try to without Republicans using the budget reconciliation process, they would need to keep all 50 of their senators in line in the Senate. So any one of them could demand something. The one that's sort of come out ahead in the news at the moment is Senator Joe Manchin. What might he ask for and have that leverage?
Senator Manchin has already asked the White House, made clear that he is not going to vote for a package that would raise the U.S. corporate rate from 21% to 28%, as Biden has proposed. Manchin has said that what he would tolerate is an increase in the corporate rate from 21% to 25%. So he's already kind of drawn that line in the sand. Where Manchin stands in other key provisions, I think, is at least not quite public yet. It's also clear that Manchin wants to show and at least a real genuine effort at bipartisanship. But on the other provisions, I don't think we know yet. The corporate tax provision, it's kind of interesting. They have proposed raising about $2.5 trillion in taxes over 15 years and spending around $2.3 trillion. Manchin's objections could lower the amount of corporate revenue by about $300 billion, which would mean that the plan would still come close to paying for itself, but not quite. And I have to wonder at least if they counted on Manchin coming out and saying that and wrote their plan in a way that would still be essentially deficit neutral but could adhere to Manchin's objections.
Jeff Stein, Washington Post economics reporter. Read his stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia has been a skeptic of what the president has been offering on infrastructure. She was interviewed today on Fox News.
Well, I mean, I just spent 2 weeks at home. We toured a lot of road and bridge projects that are ongoing that need to give our governors the flexibility to be able to pursue forward what works in rural America, urban America. We opened a new transit station in southern West Virginia. We looked at a wastewater and a clean drinking water project in the northern part of the state. Those are the basic needs, along with broadband being a new basic need, in my opinion, that I think where we need to focus and where we have that bipartisan sort of synergy where we have in the past gotten together and we can get together again. So I think we've got to take some of this extraneous stuff out. And I think it's really wrong and misleading to the American public for the president and others to say that we as Republicans are not willing to look forward to what the infrastructure of the future is. You know, we passed a bill 21 to nothing a year ago that had electric vehicle charging stations and other resiliencies in construction materials. Some of the things that I think are going to be important moving forward. But that is just a small part. 15% of the bill is in that. Let's look at what everything else is.
Senator Shelley Moore Capito today on Fox News. President Biden also using another White House meeting today to push for his infrastructure plan. It was with nearly 20 corporate leaders about the global shortage of semiconductors. He told them that the U.S. should be the world's computer chip leader and that this is also part of infrastructure. The computer chip shortage has caused disruption in many industries, including shutting down some auto factories in the U.S. for a time. On Wall Street today, the Dow was down 55, NASDAQ down 50, S&P down a fraction. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. The White House says it has reached agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala to increase military presence at their borders in an effort to limit migration to the U.S. The president chooses what the Associated Press calls two critics of Trump-era immigration policies for key roles at the Department of Homeland Security. For Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, Tucson, Arizona Police Chief Chris Magnus. And for Director of Citizenship and Immigration Services, Urge Adu, most recently head of the group DHS Watch. Cindy McCain, widow of the late Senator John McCain, is reportedly being vetted to be U.S. envoy to the United Nations Food Program in Rome. That's according to Politico. If it happens, she would be the first Biden administration's Republican appointee to a Senate-confirmed position. And President Biden's dog, Major, will receive private training away from the White House after a series of biting incidents. That's according to the press secretary to the First Lady, Michael LaRosa, speaking with The Hill. The White House COVID-19 response team says both the vaccination rate in the U.S. and the number of new cases in the U.S. continue to rise. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is director of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Over the weekend, the CDC reported 75,000 cases and 81,000 cases of COVID-19 each day. As such, CDC's most recent data show the seven-day average for new cases has increased about 3% over the prior seven-day period to over 66,000 cases daily. Hospital admissions also continue to increase. The most recent seven-day average, a little over 5,300 admissions per day, is a 6.6% increase from the prior seven-day period. And deaths decreased 5.2% to a seven-day average of 684 per day. Vaccinations continue to increase, with the most recent seven-day average of over 3 million vaccines delivered daily, and a record high day on Saturday, as Andy mentioned, of 4.6 million doses administered in just one day. We are now 82 days into the 100-day mark and have administered more than 166 million vaccinations towards the president's goal of 200 million vaccinations in the first 100 days. I want to reflect for just a moment on this tremendous progress. And while we celebrate how far we have come and our collective efforts, we also have to hold ourselves accountable. Today, CDC is releasing two reports in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report that underscore the need to address health inequities in our country, including in our vaccination efforts. The first report details trends in racial and ethnic disparities in COVID-19 hospitalizations across this country. Looking at data from March through September through December 2020, we confirmed the preliminary findings that were published last year. People from racial and ethnic minority groups are disproportionately affected by COVID-19, including being at increased risk for hospitalization.
CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky. She also said that Michigan, which has seen the nation's highest increase in COVID-19 cases, needs to enact shutdown measures in response instead of wanting additional vaccines. That's what Governor Gretchen Whitmer has asked for. Also at today's White House briefing, Dr. Anthony Fauci, top science advisor to the administration, he was asked about drug maker Pfizer's application to administer vaccines to 12 to 15-year-olds and whether the U.S. can ever reach herd immunity without vaccinating children.
So Pfizer has already mentioned that on the basis of their clinical trial, that they are going to try to look for an amended EUA for kids 12 to 15 years old, because as you might recall from a prior presentation that we made here on a press conference, they really had literally 100% efficacy with 18 events in the unvaccinated or placebo group and zero events in the vaccine group. So I think that is imminent. I know they're going to be putting in for that. We had mentioned on a couple of discussions, Andy, that we would hope that children in high school will be able to be vaccinated by the time we get to the early fall season. With regard to children and herd immunity, again, I would like to get people away from this concept of referring to something that it is very elusive in its definition, because we don't know what herd immunity percentage of vaccinated people plus people who've recovered. We've made estimates that is somewhere between 70 and 85%, but we don't know that as a fact. So that rather than concentrating on an elusive number, let's get as many people vaccinated as quickly as we possibly can, which we are doing apropos of the numbers that were just mentioned by Andy and by Dr. Walensky.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, at today's White House COVID-19 response team briefing, referring to Andy Slavitt, senior advisor. Dr. Fauci also saying that when a vaccine is authorized for children, it will be available through the pediatrician's office. India now gone past Brazil as the country with the second highest total of COVID-19 infections in the world, 13.5 million. The U.S. leads with more cases than India and Brazil combined. Congressman Dale Kildee of Michigan says that after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, he experienced PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. He tells NBC Nightly News on Sunday that when he first went home after the riot, he thought he was fine, but later watched footage and it triggered an emotional and physical reaction. He says a friend in Congress recommended a psychiatrist who specializes in trauma, Jim Gordon.
I mean, this is not something I ever expected to experience, not something that I anticipated, but I'm just really grateful that we connected and that I was able to get help when I needed it the most.
Their sessions almost every Saturday have helped, and so do the meditation techniques Gordon taught. The congressman hoping opening up now will help others do the same.
Most people who experience trauma don't experience it in real time on every network across the world. They do it privately, quietly, painfully, silently, alone. And so if I can speak to them, that's what I want to do.
Congressman Dale Kildee on NBC News. He's not the only member of Congress who has expressed these feelings. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York has said that she feared for her life on that day, January 6th. A veteran Capitol Police officer who died earlier this month in another security incident on Capitol Hill, a man ramming his car into a checkpoint, is going to be honored on Tuesday by lying in honor in the Capitol Rotunda. The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell spoke about it on the Senate floor today.
On Good Friday, the United States Capitol Police were subjected to another violent attack. Once again, our uniformed heroes wound up in harm's way. And Officer Billy Evans, a friend and favorite of many here on the Senate side, a faithful protector of the Capitol, was killed. Investigators are still assessing what drove the perpetrator to attempt this attack on the Capitol and whether domestic violent extremism played a role. He appears to have been captivated by the Nation of Islam, a racist, anti-Semitic, extreme group under the openly hateful leader, Louis Farrakhan. His attack injured Officer Ken Shaver, and it stole away the life of Officer Evans from his children, Logan and Abigail, his mother, Janice, his entire family, and all of his friends and colleagues decades too soon. Officer Evans was famous within the Senate for his friendly spirit and easy manner. He was the first face that many would see on their way to work here in the Capitol every day. His particular post often meant he was literally the first line of defense of the Congress, the interface between these grounds and the outside world. We could not have had a kinder, more likable ambassador at this junction, or a more faithful protector to keep us safe. It will be with tremendous grief, but tremendous gratitude, that we'll welcome Officer Evans to the Capitol a final time tomorrow, where he will lie in honor in the rotunda.
The Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. With more on the tribute to Officer Billy Evans and also some recommendations we could hear about this week to boost Capitol Hill security, we spoke with Associated Press Chief Congressional Correspondent Lisa Mascaro.
Officer William Evans, Billy Evans, will lie in state on Tuesday. It's an honor to be to have a civilian lie in the rotunda. He was killed two Fridays ago when a man charged one of the security stations at the sort of near the Senate entrance to the Capitol. It was a sort of shocking and alarming moment because, you know, here on Capitol Hill, you know, the security has still been extremely tight 3 months now since the January 6th insurrection. They were just beginning to bring some of the security fencing down. You know, there's been razor wire topped security fencing all around the Capitol and a quite large perimeter. And it's just really not been the kind of infrastructure that people want at the Capitol, because it's supposed to be, you know, the people's house and, you know, the representative place where people can come and talk to their lawmakers and sort of not the image that lawmakers wanted to give. However, you know, there was the January 6th insurrection, so there have been a lot of security concerns. And so this security had been tightened. And then, of course, as you know, as it was starting to come down, there was this incident. So Officer Evans will lie in state. At the same time, we're expected to hear very soon here from House Democrats who are putting forward a supplemental security bill that will have funding for all sorts of new ways to, you know, beef up security around the Capitol. Speaker Pelosi had a massive review done after the January 6th insurrection. And the report came back with lots of recommendations. And so we'll be seeing some of that. And as you mentioned, at the same time, the Inspector General Michael Bolton of the U.S. Capitol Police Force will be testifying on Thursday before the House. We've seen a number of security officials coming to testify before the House and the Senate about what happened on January 6th. And, you know, we still don't have a full picture of all of the breakdowns. You know, there was just a long time, a multi-hour gap from when the pro-Trump supporters first came to the Capitol, and then it suddenly turned sort of violent and the siege began and they stormed into the Capitol. And there were multiple hours before before you know calm was restored and before they were able to sort of clear the building. And so Congress continues to sort of look at what happened and see where the gaps were and see what can be improved.
And you mentioned that 18-year veteran, Billy Evans, the flags remaining at half staff today in his honor. He was killed, again, the fourth police officer in the last couple of months, the fourth police officer to be killed, second one in the last couple of months. But I want to go back to the issue of infrastructure because yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, the Speaker Pelosi was asked about that. But she was also asked about the price tag for security of the Capitol and what's the next step for members of Congress on that issue. Here's what she said.
We're talking about money, and we want to make sure that it is the appropriate amount, nothing less than we need, but nothing more than we need, and appropriately prioritized to, again, open up the Capitol so that it is the temple of democracy that it is, that people can come and be there with adequate protection so that they can do so safely. And the Appropriations Committee have that responsibility in addition to the committees of jurisdiction, House Administration, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So we're in a good place, and we feel, how can I say it? We think that it is the appropriate prioritizing that we're putting forward. But it's always, in legislation, it's always a conversation.
And just one quick follow-up, and then we'll get to our viewer and listener calls, and that is, how do lawmakers strike the balance? There had been initial talk about putting a wall across the Capitol, and of course, anyone who's been to Washington knows that it is a very open space, a very accessible space. So how do you have security issues dealt with, but also that openness that we've become so familiar with here in Washington, D.C.?
No, you're absolutely right. And that is the balance that the lawmakers are trying to strike. You know, folks might remember before 9/11, you know, you could just walk up to the Capitol and walk into the Capitol and visit. Certainly that's not the case after the September 11th attacks. There's, you know, security and you go through metal detectors and all of that. But the grounds are still open. And for people on Capitol Hill, I mean, anytime you come up to the Capitol, you see all sorts of people just enjoying the sort of beautiful park-like grounds that are at the Capitol. And in summer months, you see many, many tourists taking, you know, selfies and photos in front of the Capitol. People from all around the world come and, you know, take pictures and celebrate the fact that they are visiting the nation's capital. It's an, you know, it is a sort of icon of democracy the world over. And and that is the balance, as we saw after the January 6th insurrection. The perimeter was really pushed out and people were not able to enter those grounds. And, you know, I think that's really what the lawmakers are going to have to wrestle with. There's been some proposals for sort of a retractable fencing, something that could come out, you know, go out and then be brought back in, you know, just certain situations. So that's what they're going to have to wrestle with. And I think soon we will see the proposals. I was checking on that just recently, but I don't have any numbers yet for how much they're looking to spend. But, you know, there will be some proposals for increased security here at the Capitol.
Lisa Mascaro is chief congressional correspondent with the Associated Press, joining us on Monday morning's Washington Journal on C-SPAN. Congressman Andrew Clyde of Georgia recently fined for refusing to walk through metal detectors to enter the U.S. House floor, says he's prepared to challenge the penalties in court, arguing the metal detector stations are unconstitutional. He was fined $15,000 for two offenses, and the House Ethics Committee today denied his appeal. Jerusalem Post writes that U.S. Secretary of State Lloyd Austin studiously avoided any mention of Iran and its nuclear ambitions in his public statements on a two-day visit to Israel, even when his interlocutors highlighted the issue. Austin's visit took place less than 100 days into the Biden administration, was the first for a Biden cabinet member. It came as the U.S. was engaged in indirect talks with Iran to return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, full name of the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and world powers, and following recent attacks on an Iranian intelligence base at sea and its Natanz underground nuclear facility attributed to Israel. That all from the Jerusalem Post. Secretary Austin and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made statements today. First, the secretary.
Today, I was also grateful for the opportunity to meet with the Prime Minister to discuss a number of security issues that are important to our two countries. And I wanted to reaffirm the administration's strong commitment to Israel and to the Israeli people. And that's why I thought it was important that we meet face to face and to express our earnest desire for close consultations with Israel as we address shared challenges in the region. And I also wanted to underscore my personal pledge to strengthening Israel's security and ensuring Israel's qualitative military edge. The close and strong ties that we enjoy with Israel are central to regional stability and security in the Middle East, and we both agree that we must continue to work closely together to enhance the U.S.-Israel strategic partnership.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in Jerusalem. He also visited the country's Holocaust Memorial, Yad Vashem. As mentioned, he did not specifically talk about Iran as a threat, but standing beside him, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did.
You just said a moment ago in our meeting, you said, we're not just allies, we're family. We call that mishpoche. And there is so much truth in that statement that our peoples instinctively understand. As you know, the U.S.-Israel defense partnership has continually expanded over successive administrations. And our cooperation is crucial in dealing with the many threats confronting both the United States and Israel. Threats that you are very familiar with from your distinguished service in Iraq and by your command in CENTCOM. In the Middle East, there is no threat that is more serious, more dangerous, more pressing than that posed by the fanatical regime in Iran. Iran continues to support terrorists around the world in five continents, threatening civilians everywhere. Iran has never given up its quest for nuclear weapons and the missiles to deliver them. And Iran consistently and outrageously calls for Israel's annihilation and works towards that goal. Mr. Secretary, we both know the horrors of war. We both understand the importance of preventing war, and we both agree that Iran must never possess nuclear weapons.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu alongside U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in Jerusalem. Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif promising revenge against Israel after that apparent attack on an Iranian nuclear site caused a blackout there over the weekend. Israeli media outlets, quoting unnamed intelligence sources, said that Israel's intelligence agency Mossad is behind it. Today is the 40th anniversary of the first launch of the space shuttle. At the time, a revolutionary idea, a reusable space vehicle put into orbit by a rocket, then gliding back to Earth like an airplane. This is how ABC News reported Columbia's liftoff from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
Tinges of orange, brown, and black in a rosewood-like color with little or no wind. You couldn't have had a better day for launching.
Five. Four, we've gone for main engine start.
The brilliant white cloud of smoke from the rockets obscured all from view for a few moments. Then there were no more doubts. Right on schedule, 2 minutes into the flight, the solid rockets burned out and separated. There it is.
There they go. Roger on the SIP, Columbia.
The shuttle's main engines kept burning as planned for another 6 minutes, providing Bob Crippen with his first view from space.
What a view, what a view. Glad you're enjoying it.
April 12th, 1981, 40 years ago, there were two astronauts on that flight, rookie Bob Crippen and veteran John Young. The flight lasted 54 hours. Over the next 30 years, five space shuttles flew 135 missions. A sixth shuttle was built for test, never flown into space. Two shuttles, of course, lost when they blew up on launch over the years. The four surviving retired shuttles are in museums around the country. Thanks for being with us on Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And download the free C-SPAN Radio app to listen not only to C-SPAN Radio, but also the three C-SPAN TV networks. I hope you have a good evening.